Everybody, welcome to another edition of Persuasion by the Pint. I am Sean McCool, and I'm missing my better half, Jonathan Taylor, today. He has had a little bit of an infection, so hopefully he's resting in bed. But I do have a special guest with us today, Dr. Michael Barbera. Dr. Michael, welcome to the show.
Hey, I wouldn't call myself special, but I'll take it.
Well, you know, special could mean a lot of things depending on who you're talking to, right? So better take that take it however you want. So we're going to be talking about persuasion, obviously, but we're going to get into some, I was looking over your stuff and I mean, you go pretty deep into this. This is not a casual thing for you, persuasion. This is a lifelong pursuit. We'll get more into your background, but we could end up deep in the weeds here.
Possibly.
So I'm gonna rely on you to kind of translate it for us. Get our listeners. We'll stay out of too big of words, hopefully. But I was going through some of your blog articles, doing some research and things like that, and it looks very interesting. So I'm excited to talk about it. But before we do that, we always talk about our beverages first, because this is Persuasion by the Pint, after all. And I think you and I are kind of in the same lane today. I did not bring a craft beer today. I brought a different beverage. So as a guest, you can start first. Tell us a little bit about the beverage you're having, why you chose that one. And then I'll do the same. And then we'll rate them on a scale of 1 to 5 pints.
All right. So my beverage is both by choice and by opportunity. So in my office where I am now at the lab, I actually keep some Johnny Blue. As you can see, this has probably been in here for months. I don't drink it as much as I should or want to. However, being a afternoon, with this is the last thing before the weekend, absolutely, I'm more than happy to dive in. And so opportunity, because it's 3 feet away from me. However, Johnny Blue is a great beverage to have to celebrate. There's hopefully one thing to celebrate each week here at the lab. Hopefully our wins are a little bit better than our losses, and occasionally we do celebrate, especially on some of those late nights where it makes building a team worth it and fun.
Yeah, very cool. So that is that Johnny Walker, the blue label? Is that what you're?
That is.
Okay, I want to make sure I had the right thing. So I'm going to scroll this fancy little scroll down here. I know, right? Hopefully, there's no typos. That's when you try to edit your own stuff, like you never know. I'm sure somebody will let us know if there is at some point. So I was at Total Wine and Beverage. Do they have those in North Carolina? You're in North Carolina, right?
I am in North Carolina. I don't think we have any. At least I haven't seen any.
Okay. You're in Pinehurst? Golf course Pinehurst area?
It is golf course. It is golf mecca Pinehurst.
I was going to say, wasn't there just a tournament there? Was that the women's or the men's that was...
Neither. The Women's Open will be here next June. So the Women's Open that just ended in San Francisco will be here in 12 months.
Okay. Maybe that's what I heard them talking about. I remember hearing the Pinehurst. So, all right. Very cool. I got some friends that would be very envious that you live there for sure. So what I've got today is I went into to Total Wine to find a new stock of beers, because we're always looking for new beers. And then I kind of strolled down one aisle, and they had a whole section of kind of pre-mixed cocktails, which I think is pretty cool marketing. You know, they probably make a lot. I imagine the profit's more on those than it is probably on the straight liquor. So, but this one caught my eye. It was Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Lemonade. So kind of a pre-mixed, and it's getting in the 90s today here in Texas. So it's like, it felt like a good pour for today.
I'm gonna try that. I haven't heard of that. Probably a decade plus ago, around maybe 2009, 2011, my preferred go-to was American Honey. And somewhere, I guess, I don't know, I just fell off with life. And so, but I also, given when in Rome, my preferred, non-alcoholic beverage is Arnold Palmer's. And so being lemonade and honey, I'm gonna give that a shot. I'm gonna see if they have those available here.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I had one earlier this week, so this is not my first time, but decided I'd go all out, put it in a mason jar, just go the whole route. So cheers to you, Michael.
Salute.
And We usually rate these on a scale of 1 to 5 pints, 5 being the highest, and you can do any, you know, decimal points you want. You know, so what would you give? It's your go-to, so I'm curious, like, where on the range it falls for you.
My go-to, I'm going to say this is, can I use points, like 4 point something, or is it just 4 or 5?
Yeah, as many decimals as you want.
I'm going to go with 4.9. Nothing in life is ever perfect, so I'll get as close as possible with a 4.9.
Okay, I like it. I'm going to give this, we're pretty tough on our, because we've had so many things, but it's actually pretty, it's 7% alcohol, which is surprising for like this type of mixed drink, but goes down smooth. I'm going to give it a solid 4. It's not my typical craft, dark craft beer that I would drink, but for this kind of weather, it's perfect. That little honey, little lemonade, little whiskey, hard to go wrong.
Is that carbonated?
It does have a little bit of carbonation in it, just a little bit. So I'm not sure why. Maybe that's just for preservatives or something. Who knows? But yeah, it does have just a little bit of, if you pour it too fast, it will spill over on you. So, but it's good quality drink, great for the boat, golf course, any of those things. Probably wouldn't want too many on the golf course at 7%, but you know, it depends on how well you hold your alcohol. All right, well, let's dive in. I'm super excited. Let me read a little bit about our guest today. He said I could paraphrase, but because it's a long bio. But Dr. Michael Barbera is an award-winning consumer psychologist and business strategist for Fortune 50 companies, leading expert in the complex factors that drive the entire consumer decision-making process, including consumer behavior, emotion, and experience. His practice areas include social psychology, decision-making, brand management, marketing, product placement, and long-term business growth strategies. He has worked with large organizations, including Boeing, Microsoft, The Washington Post, John Deere, Harley-Davidson, Lendlease, United States Department of Defense, United States Department of State. Saw some other cool stuff here. In 2015, the White House recognized Michael for his many contributions to entrepreneurship. Michael shares research, insights, and thought leadership as a celebrated keynote speaker, host of the ClickSuasion podcast, and dynamic TEDx presenter. So, Dr. Michael, welcome again to the show.
I'm still here.
There you are. All right. So let's just kind of dive. I was going through your site, and we're just going to kind of feel our way through this. ClickSuasion, which is ClickSuasion Labs, that's your company, correct?
That's right.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about how that came about and kind of how you ended up there. Give that little bit of background.
You mentioned earlier that this is potentially a lifelong pursuit. You know, that's not terribly incorrect. However, you know, I work in consumer psychology. The technical name for the field is behavioral economics. Very rarely do you hear a child wake up in the morning and say, I want to be a behavioral economist when I grow up. Like, what is that? So let's go back, way back to the mid-early 90s. I was a drummer in a rock band at the age of 13. In New York City. And so every Halloween, we would host, our guitarist's parents had a backyard. Every Halloween, we would hold this Halloween party there and have some bands play. Now, if you have a backyard in New York City, that's kind of cool. You've got some property. That's significant. And this one year, his parents were selling the home, so we couldn't use the backyard for this party. So I'm thinking, there's got to be another way. So I get on the telephone, again, pre-internet day, start calling all these venues throughout the New York City area, from the large Roseland Ballroom to Irving Plaza, to the local VFW, Knights of Columbus, and then found this place out in Staten Island called The Caves. Quite a cool venue. It is literally built into rock. It's a former brewery. It's got several different caves, two stages, 5 bars, quite a cool venue. So I go there. Now, at 13, I look like I was 22. So as long as I didn't drink any alcohol, cheers, and didn't ruin the privilege of me being there. No one ever questioned my validity being in that establishment. I linked up or met the owner, operator, manager, and presented what I wanted to do. He's like, sure, let's do it. So we put on this concert, pretty much rent this venue out. And then it was all day concert, 22 bands, 2 stages. And the only thing I knew about business at the age of 13 was revenue minus expenses equals profit. Pretty much don't spend more than you make. Like, how hard could it be, right? Yeah. And we made a profit. And the owner, operator, manager said, let's do it again. Let's do it again and again. And we had a business. And it turns out that the owner, operator, manager of that club, the Caves, was AJ Perro. AJ Perro was the drummer for Twisted Sister. He has since passed away, but he was my kind of first unofficial mentor. We didn't sit down and have conversations about, you know, what to do and how to do, but I learned just from observing what he did and, more importantly, what he did not do. At the age of 17, that business was acquired. It's still in business today as Catalyst Promotions. They're headquartered out of Tampa. I have no affiliation with that today. However, in that journey from 13 to 17, I would have these observations of how people made decisions at the bar, when buying their tickets, when buying products from bands throughout the concert venues, merchandise. And I was always curious about how people made one choice over another. And then eventually I went to college and learned there's a whole field of study of this. It's called behavioral science, behavioral economics. Well, here I am. Many years later, through different types of consulting and, you know, my academic life, my entrepreneurial life transitioned to an academic life, back to entrepreneurial life. So really, I am a psychologist by formal education and training, but an entrepreneur by torture.
Very nice. Wow. 13 years old. So 13 to 17, that's 4 years of some serious education. Did you learn more there or in college?
I would say equal for both. I have two MBAs, in executive management and another in entrepreneurship. So let's talk the MBA in entrepreneurship. You'll learn some great foundational models for launching or crafting a product or a business, but it doesn't teach you how to start the business. You get that knowledge from doing it, from failing. My father was my first employee. So how do you run payroll at the age of 15? What do you know about payroll taxes and getting a Department of Revenue number? And so you learn all of the doing tasks, the actionable stuff, but you also pick up the frameworks, the theory, the strategic knowledge in academia. So I would say it's equal. They're both valuable to business development.
Cool. All right. So we've kind of got, so you fell into this, not fell into, but you studied this behavioral economics, behavioral science. Kind of give us the definition of, that was one of my questions. Like, what exactly is behavioral science or economics? Like, how would you define it? And then dumb it down for the rest of us once you define it.
I'll give two answers. Traditional economics is based upon utilitarian needs. So you buy a house because you need shelter. You buy food because you need subsistence. Behavioral economics is making decisions or financial decisions based upon wants, needs, or emotions. However, pretty much if microeconomics and applied psychology had a baby, that would be behavioral economics. So for example, we can probably get by living in a studio apartment, but we prefer the 5-bedroom house with a pool. We can probably get by in a Vespa or having a bus pass, but we prefer to drive a Maserati. So we buy things based upon experience than utility. And that's the premise or foundation of behavioral economics.
Got it. All right. So as we move forward, I was going through some of your studies. Is there any like big glossary things we need to get out of the way? Like the word heuristics, for example, are any of those kind of words that we need to kind of put out there and describe before we start talking about some of the details? Or should we just...
I'm more than happy to share the detail of what a heuristic is. However, I'll also give analogies of the work without being technical. We'll have some fun even though I am a researcher and I study human behavior, I'm still flawed. I still like to go shopping like everyone else. I'm like, if I'm at a store, I'll be like, you know what? That's good. Well, darn you, IKEA. That is genius. I wish I would have thought of that myself. But here,
that is funny, right? I mean, that's like, we know this stuff. I mean, like as a copywriter, like I know good copy when I see it and it still works. Like that's the cool stuff about all this. It still works, even though, you know, do you think it works better if you know it? Because they say salespeople are the easiest people to sell. You know, that's an old saying.
I don't know. I think I get tougher and grumpier when it comes to sales as I age and learn more about research. I think my standards get higher and I get grumpy when someone reaches out to me and they don't use applied science or persuasive principles. So I think it's more frustrating for me. I think it's more of a sort of a case study. And I've come up with these like policies for myself where if someone asks me, well, what do you do for a living? And then they proceed to tell you something. Well, if I had to tell you what I do, I'm probably not going to buy it. So I get grumpy in my old age, when it comes to persuasion and sales.
Yeah, I can see that. Cause like I do, like if the salesperson doesn't hit a couple like key things that I think they should be doing, I'm like, dude, you're not even doing the basics. Like I can't give you my money and give you a commission if you don't at least do the basic. But if they do hit those things, you know, I'm happy to give them because I've been on that side, you know, so I appreciate the, it's kind of like if you've ever waited tables, right? Like you have a lot more respect for people who are servers or than if you've never done that.
Yeah. So in your scenario, as being a marketer and working in copy, I would assume that you're critical of other people's writing. So I'm confident that if you were to read any kind of, say, text-based advertisement, whether it be from a brochure, a magazine, or a digital ad, I'm sure your anxiety peaks when you see something that breaks principles that you follow and that you would advocate for with your own work or your clients or your team members.
Yeah, for sure. And then I have to remind myself that I don't actually know the results because just because it doesn't look right doesn't mean it's not working.
I couldn't agree more. There's a reason why it went there. It doesn't mean it was a bad reason. We just don't know. So for example, most times when I see an exclamation point in copy, I cringe because according to human eye tracking, when the eye comes across an exclamation point, it bounces away. It's a physical and visual barrier for the eye to continue reading. So it's difficult to have a call to action below an exclamation point. So when I see that, I cringe. But they might have other research that suggests in that specific scenario that it's a positive effect.
That's good. I mean, you're talking about like that is a very like detailed observation, or I guess it's more than an observation. It's data, right? So. But I feel that way. Like, I think the better you get at copy, the less you use exclamation points. You might go, you start to maybe use too many ellipses, you know, dot, dot, dot. but definitely like one of the clients I'm working with now, they hate, you know, exclamation points. And I agree. Like it's overdone and it's usually a sign of kind of amateurish copy for sure. But that's fascinating that it literally causes. So what's going on with that? Like what's any idea what's behind that? Like from a human nature standpoint, why do people react and their eye goes somewhere else when they see an exclamation point?
Well, it's a wall. Well, one, it's a wall. So when the eye sees it, it's difficult to perceive that.
Literally it's like, instead of a period, it's like this full vertical wall for your eye to go past.
It's exactly what it is. It's also aggressive, where in some scenarios, consumers don't want to be spoken to in an aggressive manner. It's more, we want to be friendly and positive. So we kind of tend to shy away from exclamation points.
So how does that, I'm curious, like, so how does that, you know, a lot of salespeople, like enthusiasm sells, right? So like if you're in person, not too much. So I'm curious, like how that works. I guess there's no visual representation of like that wall. It's interesting because I think.
Well, you can be enthusiastic. You just can't. So you can't. You wouldn't say exclamation point. So it's like
right.
your body language, your spoken language can say excited, but your written word probably shouldn't. So I mean, it would be weird if I was to be like, yes, that's awesome, Sean, exclamation point. It just doesn't fit, but I could say, I could be excited and still support and be into the conversation. But then that becomes likable, it becomes relatable, which are two other persuasive principles. Likability is probably one of the most powerful persuasive principles there is because we want to be around other people who are like us. And so if I believe that you're like me, I'm going to gravitate towards you and I'm more likely to comply with a call to action, build a friendship, or want to be liked by you because we apparently have one or two similar variables in our lifestyle.
Yeah. So now I'm curious. My brain's like, what else do we know about punctuation marks? You could probably write a whole book on this, or at least a paper. Is there any other like stuff that we don't know about, the average person does not know about punctuation marks?
I don't think, you know, thinking through the research, I'm not sure there's any research that I'm aware of that shows significant data on other punctuation. I don't think there is. I'm sure in some scenarios where for you to use, you know, a specific mark with this variable, it might have a different affect, but nothing that I'm aware of. So like me personally, I love ellipses. I'm an ellipses fan, but then Grammarly tells me, no, get lost, stop using that. And I have to change.
Yeah. So Hemingway apps the same way. So neither one of them like it. I think it messes with their, like, we don't know if this is a sentence or not. Like, so it messes with the algorithm, I guess. They don't like that. All right. So cool. So there's a couple of different places I definitely wanted to go for our listeners. One, I wanted to talk about the weather and temperature. And then two, I want to talk about menus. Saw that on your website. There's some cool stuff there. And then one thing I definitely wanted, before we do those two things, we talk a lot on this show with other, you know, other guests. You know, we talk about, you know, finding your right avatar and who you're going to talk to and those things. And we know demographics are pretty basic stuff, and it's kind of the where you start. But just real quick for our listeners, could you explain the importance? And this is coming up for me because I was watching a video with a previous guest, Rich Sheffrin, over at Strategic Profits. He was talking about the difference between demographics and behavior. So if you wanted to create a lookalike list, you wouldn't want a demographic lookalike. You'd want a behavioral lookalike. So
I'd want both.
Okay.
I would want to know both. So demographics would be anything that you pretty much have no control over that can be categorized. So that would be your age. You can't control your age, your ethnicity, your gender, which you can control. So most things are non-controllable. So your gender, your ethnicity, your age, and then the subcategories, therefore, where behavior is something that you do voluntarily, or maybe not voluntarily, but it's not something that you were, say, stuck with at birth. If I wanted to look for a person by demographics, maybe we segment between 26 and 31 year olds who are male and are of Asian American descent. However, you can add a behavior on there. We can say 26 to 31 year old male Asian Americans who drive northbound on I-95 for their morning commute. So that's more of a behavior. Where does this person go? What do they do? How likely is a person to stop by their favorite coffee shop in the morning on the way to work? That's a behavior. And so targeting behaviors is more likely to be in conjunction with the likability factor. It's what we call bundling in behavioral economics. If you can bundle two things that the person does together and then target those two, you're more likely to have a positive reaction from the consumer or the user because they're already seeing your brand message, your marketing, your copy, et cetera, in conjunction with two things they might like. So the behavior is something that we voluntarily or we're not born with and we do on a recurring or somewhat recurring basis, whereas demographics is something that we have almost no control over.
So is that where marketing is going with trying to track both and getting more and more, you know, really trying to follow the behavior patterns of people?
I would hope so. You know, some organizations are spot on and some are struggling to keep up. But you know what? Not every organization needs to target certain demographics or behaviors. So, for example, let's use Starbucks, for example. Starbucks, when was the last time that we've seen a Starbucks advertisement? Probably not too often. Their model's pretty much self-sustaining without having advertising. They do internal marketing. Once you're a customer, you maybe download the app and there's internal touch points once you've already made that first conversion. However, looking at, say, you want to target demographics. So we're working on a project here at the lab and with a regional company, we need to target females for a specific product, but females also likely have school-age children who are in primary school. So where would these females likely go? Okay, so where would these females also likely go when they have access to a digital advertisement? So now breaking down these barriers and identifying some of the behaviors, we identify, well, a female who is on their mobile device or has access to look at a screen while they have some time and they have school-aged children. So we geofenced the roads where the school waiting lines are. So when mothers are dropping off their children in the morning, we've geofenced that area, and we use a time-based methodology on that geofencing. So it only geofences from, you know, 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. And so whoever's waiting in that line for that geofenced area is being receiving that digital advertisement.
That's cool. And then you can do the same thing at pickup time, because I think the wait, I remember doing that with my kids, and it feels like the wait was even longer in the afternoons because everybody tried to get there first. That's amazing that we live in a day and age where you can do that. I mean, that's just, it's amazing. I'm curious, like how is some of this new, like Apple iOS 15 stuff? I mean, do you get into some of that, how it's preventing any of that, or is it because you're doing larger groups, it doesn't really matter? What are you seeing?
It depends. If your audience is more niche, if your audience is security averse, it might be a challenge or might present an issue or concern. But still, with the iOS 15, the user still needs to opt into those security measures. And then right. when you download another app, you still have to opt in for security for that single app as well. So how likely are you going to opt in for every one of these apps? More than likely not. Some people do. However, at this early stage, we haven't seen a significant negative effect in targeting people based upon retargeting RFID, Bluetooth, et cetera, any of their behavior on their mobile device.
That's good news, I guess, for a lot of advertisers out there. Because as you know, anything like that that comes along, there's a lot of doom and gloom that goes with it. And but at least it's a level playing field, right? It's not like it's targeting anybody. It is,
you know, but that persuasion part goes two ways, you know. So you may feel, I say you, the consumer, North Americans may feel like they're being targeted because they receive an ad on a mobile app or on their cell phone, or because they visited a website or they drove past a Starbucks. If you drive past a Starbucks and you have the Starbucks app on your phone, more than likely you're going to receive a drop-down notification nudging you or asking you to purchase a beverage. But then when you look at data and when people, you know, how people prefer ads, most North Americans actually prefer a relevant ad. So let's say you have no children and you got ads for Gerber baby products. That's not relevant to you. So it actually increases the frustration. And when looking at, say, facial expression analysis data for people looking at non-relevant ads, there's a significant increase in anxiety and anger because it is, why am I seeing this? It's not relevant. So we prefer to see those targeted ads because we at some point engage in a behavior that triggered that. Additionally, I forgot where I was going with the next part. So skip the additionally.
All right. Yeah. So it's like, if you have friends, you want to hear from your friends. So like if you have advertisers or marketer or companies that you like, you don't mind hearing from them as much, you know, like you said, Starbucks, it's like, yeah, I could use a whatever right now, you know, iced coffee and it's hot out. I'd love to. And I'm driving by. Oh yeah. Why don't I just go ahead and grab that? Or I'm in the airport. There's one at the terminal or whatever. So it's interesting you said that about Starbucks. Until you said, I didn't realize that I don't see that many advertisements other than maybe a billboard when an exit's coming up or something like that. Very, very specific, but yeah, not like Coke or somebody else advertising nonstop on every media available.
And, you know, so I actually remember the additionally, but I want to add on to that Starbucks conversation. So seeing that billboard on the interstate is quite new. So Starbucks is now building a campaign to open up more brick and mortar restaurants in conjunction with interstate exits, because, again, behavioral data from maps suggests that when people are searching Google Maps or stuff near me, they're searching for coffee. But on, say, rural interstates in rural areas, there's not many options. So that's where Starbucks are starting to build other areas. But the additionally part I was going to mention before is that, you know, we benefit from the behavioral targeting, from the data collection. You know, there's a significantly higher benefit to collecting the data than it is to not collect it and opt out, because you're driving to a friend's house for dinner. You left your house 5 minutes late. You're likely to hit traffic. You put Google Maps on. but now you opted out and now you no longer see other people's data because you can't see if there's a red line or if there's traffic, and you get guided into, right into traffic. Well, that same data that targets your behavior also tells you if there's traffic in front of you and to offer you an alternate route.
Really? Wow. I did not know that. Well, that's like, yeah, I agree with you. Like, I know Apple's like really push. I've seen some TV commercials in the last week, especially where they're really pushing this to opt in to all this stuff. Like they've actually got a campaign where it's like the guy goes around and all the people that he's interacting with follow him home into his apartment and everything. And it's like super crowded and loud, and he presses the opt out button and they all disappear.
And I think it's a phenomenal ad. They chose a phenomenal song for it. I can't think of the name of the song, but the lyrics match perfect to the person's behavior and what they're thinking as they're walking through their day. And the advertisers are all huddled around them.
But you're saying that you find that that's not what consumers actually want? Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Well, no. So if you were to ask directly to a consumer, would you prefer more security on your mobile device? Of course they're going to say, and most are going to say yes.
Right.
But then do most actually know what that security does? Maybe. But then do they also know that when you add that security, you're also removing the beneficial options, like identifying if a restaurant is busy at 5 o'clock on Google My Business or the Google My Apps Maps app. So that's the data that's being collected to track your behavior is also giving you those incentives of, hey, here's an alternate route. This restaurant's busy, et cetera. So you remove the good parts as well.
Yeah. Sounds like something that a lot of companies need to be kind of fighting back with that information to educate consumers on that kind of stuff. Because I had no idea about Google Maps. That's a great example. It's kind of like cookies when cookies came out for websites, right? There's some benefits to having cookies. Like it remembers what's in your shopping cart when you abandon it and you want to go back to Amazon and buy that thing. Like all that stuff is important. All right. Well, let's, it's all right with you. I want to switch gears a little bit. I want to talk about some of these kind of cool examples of how behavior is affected by what seems like fairly obscure things. So the first one I want to talk about is weather, or I guess temperature specifically. You had a couple things on your site about temperature and pricing.
Yeah, so we've completed a couple of studies here at the lab for how temperature cues affect people's willingness to pay. So for example, the hotter the weather, the more money you're likely to pay, and vice versa with cold weather. So if I was to say, go ahead and write down the last two numbers of your phone number. And then if I was to ask you the second question is, how old was George Washington when he passed away? More than likely, if the last two digits of your phone number are higher, then more than likely the answer to the second question will be higher as well. If your phone number, your last two digits were lower, more than likely the answer you would provide for George Washington's death age would also be lower as well. So we are anchored by items around us. And so more so where the weather comes into play is that the variable was there was a temperature or a temperature. I was going to say temperature as a thermometer. Stay with it, Mike. Is a thermometer behind the point of sale or where the purchase was being made that had the temperature displayed. And so the higher the temperature, the customer was willing to pay a higher price, whereas the lower temperature, they're willing to pay a lower amount. And so numbers around us do have an effect. Just like if you were buying, say, wine, if you're listening to this episode and you're like, man, Sean and Mike annoyed me, I really need a drink. So you go to your favorite grocery store, you walk inside, you go to the wine section, there's two bottles of wine on the shelf. One costs $9, the other costs $19. Two questions. Question number one, which one would you rather buy for yourself? Most people would choose the $9 for themselves. But if I ask Sean, which one would you prefer to take to a friend's house for dinner?
Yeah, pick the better one because I don't want to be cheapskate.
Right. We don't want to appear to be the cheap friend. So we go with the $19 bottle of wine. But then in another scenario, if you walk into the grocery store and there's three bottles available, $9, $19, and $99, when you see the $99 bottle of wine, more than likely you have this micro moment, this cognitive processing, and you say, that's ridiculous. That's stupid. I'm not going to pay $99 for a bottle of wine. Some people would, and that's okay. Most people would have that quick micro moment thought. But then when the $19 bottle is present, when the consumers were said, which one are you buying for yourself? They chose the $19 bottle of wine because it appears more reasonable compared to the $99 bottle of wine. So numbers in conjunction with them next to each other do have do affect one another. So you want to talk about menus. Menus is great when it comes to anchoring in numbers. If you have ever been to an Applebee's, Sean, I'm sure you've been to an Applebee's, right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, yep. At this point, who hasn't in North America?
Yeah.
But have you ever?
I'm an 80s kid. I remember Bennigan's. So I wish Bennigan's would come back.
Yeah, you know, we had a Bennigan's here not too long ago, like maybe like a decade ago. Yeah. Are they still in business?
I don't know. I don't think so. But they had a couple. They had a Monte Cristo sandwich that I could not. That was my go-to. And then they had the Death by Chocolate dessert that was like those. It's like 6,000 calories right there. But anyway. We digress.
We have at least a little,
yeah. We have at least a little bit of 80s trivia on every show. So,
and then the menus. So what at Applebee's? Have you ever had the surf and turf?
I have not.
You know,
it doesn't seem like something I would buy there.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So I've been asking that question for a decade, maybe, and maybe two people have answered yes to that question, and. They answered yes because they have worked at Applebee's, so it was available to them. But that surf and turf, there might be one lobster tail frozen in the freezer, but it's not meant to be sold. It's meant to anchor the consumer to choose another item. So whereas if you were to look at the top right of the trifold Applebee's menu, it's where you're going to see your entrees. You might see chicken sandwich, chicken plates, steak, surf and turf, but then the surf and turf, depending on where you reside in the country, is either going to cost $23, $25, or $27, yet nothing else in the menu costs that much. But you're comparing it to the other items that cost $15, $17, and $19. So it makes the other items look more reasonable. Because if you didn't have that anchored item, then we would compare Applebee's prices to their competitor, maybe across the street. Also with anchoring on menus, when we look at menus and we see that little like that company logo, like, hey, it's a preferred item. We should try that. It looks like it should be really good. But would the company really put that on the menu if it wasn't good? I hope not, at least. Yeah. But that little logo there is meant to anchor you to say, it's a preferred item. I might like that. But it's there to anchor you to an item that has a higher profit margin than other items. Because the menu is one of the most persuasive items. Because when you go to a big box store, let's say you walk into Walmart, Target, Sam's Club, Costco, no one's there to say, hey, Sean, welcome to Walmart. Here's a menu of everything we have to offer. No, it's right. Good luck. Navigate the store. Figure out what you want. So the restaurant is giving you a literal list of everything they have to offer. And then, you know, more than likely, like 99.999%, you're going to make a purchase off of that menu once you are seated. However, you know, at this point, it's not worried about the consumer making a purchase. It's making the purchase that has the highest profit margin. So we use anchors and visual displays to point people towards which item to purchase, which is hopefully the one with the higher profit margin, your chickens, your nachos, etc. I have this right here. I'm going to pull this out. So this is why, again, I love menus. A friend of mine said, hey, Mike, hey, can you take a look at my brochure? And I was like, oh, your brochure? Okay, sure, I'll give you a brochure. And now when you think brochure, you're thinking this trifold, glossy, you're thinking trash, right? When someone gives you a brochure, what do you do with it? You throw it in the garbage. So
right.
He hands me this brochure, and I'm going to hold it to my head so you can see it. I mean, there's a little glare from the window, but this is quite substantial. This is big, and I'm like, and it's got cardstock.
So for our listeners, like, what size would that be? For our listeners, you can see the video on persuasionbythepint.com. But it looks like it's probably what? It's probably 11 and a half by.
Possibly. Eight? I owe you a measure. I thought I had a measuring tape here, so I was going to measure it for you.
Yeah, it's probably 11 and a half by eight or something. I mean, it's pretty.
Something like that.
Well, it's not quite a full sheet of paper, but it looks as long as a full sheet of paper.
Well, I'm going to open it up.
Okay. So now it's like 11 by 14, I bet.
So vertical, it is. That is 9 inches. So is it 11 by
14 or 17, maybe?
No, 16 and a quarter.
Okay. Yeah.
And so
it's cardstock. I can hear it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's quite substantial. And so it's got
Spider-Man on the front, right?
It does have Spider-Man. I don't know how that's going to work with intellectual property, but we're not here to talk legal stuff. We're here to talk brochures. So I'm like, dude, you don't have a brochure. You've got a menu. This is a menu of services, because menu in itself is persuasive. When someone says, hey, Sean, here's my brochure, you're like, oh, garbage. But if someone says, here's a menu, like, oh, okay, I'll open it up. Because then your mind goes to this happy place of being in a restaurant. You know, we've all been to a horrible restaurant, but we still continue to go back to restaurants. So it doesn't keep us away. So when someone says, here's a menu, you're bundling a positive experience with something that is usually negative, a brochure. So by reframing it, people are more likely to engage with it, because it's no longer a brochure. It's no longer spam. It's a menu of services. Ooh, menu. I like menus. And there
that's
you go.
A great, I mean, that's, I don't want to gloss by this, because that's a great point, Michael, because if I put that together with what you just said, with the idea that everybody buys when they go to a restaurant virtually, right? So if you tell somebody it's a menu of services, I would think that just because of past behavior with the word menu, they're more likely to buy off of a menu than they are a brochure, right? Just calling it the menu of services, there's a little bit more neural pathways probably that's like, oh, menu, I have to pick something. That's why we're here.
More than likely. Yes, I would agree with you.
I mean, I know it's going to be a little different if you're depending on what, you know, if you go to the Porsche dealership and they say, here's a menu of our cars, that's probably going to be a little, you know, your percentage is not going to be the same as a restaurant, but still, it definitely would have to tick something in those worn neural pathways that hear the word menu or see a menu.
Yeah, because you go to the Porsche dealership, you don't want to look at a brochure. You want to stick your head in the window and get that new car smell.
Yes.
And then you could see yourself driving in that vehicle and then hopefully want to buy one as well.
I want to buy it before I get there, but that's just me. So, so that's cool. So I totally get like the price comparison between similar items, you know, two items on a menu, you anchor the higher price, maybe you spend a little bit more than you would, or they can just up all the prices in general because in relation to that price. But I'm still fascinated by this idea of random numbers, like a temperature, and then you're willing to spend more. Like, how can people use that? Like, you know, if on your sales page, on your website, or things like that, how do we take advantage of that in an ethical way? But I mean, do you just need statistics that have higher numbers, and like any higher number works, or like what?
Well, that's challenging. So in the study where the temperature cues were measured was with a hotel brand in the IHG brand of hotels. And so the temperature was behind the counter at the check-in/checkout. And when I'm trying to think of all the variables in the study, when the participant who was an actual paying customer was asked to choose or value their stay, the value went higher when the temperature was higher, behind, you know, in front of them or behind the person at the counter. And then, of course, the opposite for the lower temperatures. So using that in sales and marketing might be a little challenging, because the temperature can change, the weather changes. Even with that you know, geofencing software, we can turn it on and off time. You can also turn on and off with weather as well. So it's difficult. Now, if you're in, say, food service, let me rephrase that. Let's say you have a product or service that sells more based upon the time of day. Then maybe you can change or modify your pricing strategy to match people's behavior when they visit your store. So let's say, for example, let's use Starbucks again. Let's make this up. Sorry, Starbucks, you're getting picked on today. Most of their sales occur in the AM hours, and they have a lower number of sales in the PM hours. Yet most Starbucks are open till 8 or 11 PM, depending on their geographic location. So if they're open till 11, they're still hoping for sales, but the activity at Starbucks, again, is significantly less active than it is in the morning. So maybe the price of the afternoon drinks are a slightly lower cost than the drinks in the morning. However, that also doesn't show us what is the customer willing to pay for that beverage, because there's different values involved. So it's complicated to say.
That's kind of the idea behind happy hours too, right? I mean, Sonic is a good if we stay in the food world, like Sonic has their afternoon happy hours because they're they do pretty well at breakfast, but lunch is their big time. And then getting people in there, you know, mid-afternoon, late afternoon, it's not really a dinner place for most people. So they have happy hours where all your slushes are half price at from 4 to 6 p.m.
Well, you know, Expedia uses weather-based targeting. And also, really? So even though Expedia cannot control the prices, they can still nudge people based upon the weather. So let's say you reside in South Dakota or Western Minnesota, say somewhere around the Sioux Falls Airport, or within, that would be your preferred airport, the Sioux Falls Regional Airport. Spirit Airlines flies from Sioux Falls to Orlando at a fairly low cost. If there is weather forecasted for Sioux Falls, South Dakota, that is snow, or there's a blizzard happening, more than likely you're going to receive ads for Florida or sitting on a beach or at Disney. And therefore that identifies people to say, well, I don't want to be in this mess of a weather. Let me get out of here and secure a trip. And the thing goes for the opposite. If you're in Miami in the summertime and it's 105 degrees and 94% humidity, you'll likely receive ads for a cabin in the mountains, depending on the weather. So the Expedia's ads are targeting based upon weather at the point of the advertisement.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense to me. Like, logically, I can kind of see that. But what's fascinating is just like sometimes seeing a higher number and then, like you did with the George Washington example, like just thinking of one number affects the next number and what you're likely to do.
Let's get technical there. That's called the availability bias. We're making decisions based upon the information that is available to us. If I was to say, name three adult beverages, more than likely one of those three is going to be the one you're holding in your hand because it's available to you.
Right.
If you were to...
it's also recency, right? It'd also be recency?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Which goes in conjunction with availability and time base. So if I was to say, go ahead and tell me what you know about marker development, just making this up, and then you start Googling marker development, well, you're likely going to choose something from the first page of Google and then provide an answer from there. You're less likely to go to the second, third, fourth page because you're going to go with information that is available to you. It's just like the battle that social media is having with, say, fictitious news or inaccurate reporting or people sharing, say, misinformation, because people are making decisions based upon what other people are sharing because we see that as reliable because it's available to us. Now, although most people don't think objectively, like say, hey, oh, that's, it may be available to me, but it's not reliable. How objective is this? We see it like, oh, okay, that's my information for the day. And that's how we gather information and make decisions. There's so much noise around us. So, you know, as humans, we are so busy. We as North Americans don't like to read. We don't like to search for stuff. We like things to be handed to us. So we're less likely to go digging for information. We use what's there. So say, for example, we're driving home from work and we approach a red light that we know is long. It's like a 3-minute red light. So we've been wanting to go to Sean's website all day. So let me go to Sean.com. I hit enter and it's loading. It's loading. It's loading. 1-1000, 2-1000, 3-1000. 4-1000. At that point, we're likely to bounce. That's too long for us to wait because we want things that are available to us right now. And because it won't load right away within 4 seconds, we're more likely to bounce and move somewhere else. So we'll find seanscompetitor.com and get what we need from there because their website loaded. So availability and access to information or access to resources is significant because our willingness to wait for something or to find something is we're not very patient as a society.
Yeah, I've noticed that for sure. There's a couple. So, I mean, what I hear you saying is your brain is always looking for shortcuts. Any way it can save time and energy, whether it's for your benefit or not, the ultimate benefit is saving time and energy to your brain.
So if you were to go onto your iPhone, you can create shortcuts. You can create logic on your phone to say, when I'm at home, remind me of this. Our brain is actively making those shortcuts. So you mentioned the word heuristic earlier. So a heuristic is something that we do without thought, without any kind of objective or thorough thought process. So if I was to say, I'm going to drop this marker right there and it's going to fall and put it back on the table and say, okay, Mike, go pick up your marker. More than likely, 9 times out of 10, even more than that, I'm going to pick it up with my right hand because I'm right-handed. If you're left-handed, more than likely you would pick it up with your left hand. But you didn't think about pick it up. Should I pick it up with my foot or my hand? My mouth. Okay, let me go grab it with my mouth. We don't have that dialogue. Like when you're driving and you know you have to make a right-hand turn, you just turn on the right turn signal. You don't think about like, right up. Okay, good. It's an automatic thought. So our brain is actively finding shortcuts because just like we are exhausted at the end of the day, our brain is exhausted and wants to find the easiest method or the most efficient way of completing X.
All right. That's cool. I could go in so many different directions, but what I want to talk about, one other thing that I had on my list here, and then we'll talk a little bit more about what you guys do at ClickSuasion. This article caught my attention since we're kind of coming out of the pandemic now, this idea of revenge spending. And is there a way for us as marketers to kind of take advantage of this? Is this a short-term trend? Like how long do you see that? And first define it and then tell me kind of what you've learned about this idea of revenge spending.
Revenge spending is the fear of missing out on all the things we already missed out from last year. So say we were in quarantine for a year plus and we weren't able to go to a restaurant. Well, now we thought about for that year is things we can't have. You take something away from someone and we want it even more. Sean, you can't have this beverage. Now you want it even more. So when you take things away, we kind of lean towards it and have more of a desire towards it. So now that we couldn't have it and now we're ready to get out and enjoy life again, people, North Americans, are willing to spend money on the activities that we missed out on and we don't want to miss out on them again. So we're willing to pay for them and willing to pay a higher price for it. So for example, facial coverings were, the trend. And now that we can show our mouths again, Ulta has experienced a 65% increase in sales in the current quarter. And majority of that is attributed to lipstick. And then we can start showing our mouths again. So where we want to show it off. We want to go out to a restaurant. And really the revenge spending is mostly occurring in the activities that were most restricted or that we were told we can't do. Meeting with others, restaurants, dining, travel, sporting events, live in-person experiences, anywhere where there's gatherings of people. So we're spending money to get out to travel. And we feel like we're getting back at society. You told me I couldn't go anywhere. You know what? I'm going to spend money. And you know, we don't have that dialogue, but that's the behavior if we were to define it. And so revenge spending is here. Revenge spending is likely to be active. I would say, okay, let me redefine that. Revenge spending in its current form is likely to stay at peak levels through Labor Day. That's what we're predicting. It's still going to be higher than what it was, say, pre-pandemic going into September, October in the holiday season, but it will start to decrease each month over time as we start getting away from Labor Day. Because, you know, as humans, things are short-lived, right? So if I was to ask you in October, how much did the pandemic affect your lifestyle? And you're likely to say, at a 10-point scale, 8, 9, or 10. If I asked you that same question today, most people would say, 5. It wasn't so bad. We got through it, depending on who's answering. So we are short-sighted. We see things like, again, availability. What's in front of us is, it's sunny outside. Don't have to wear a facial covering. So it wasn't so bad after all. We made it through. But we're spending on items that we couldn't have, and we fear that we're going to miss out on moving forward.
So is there a way to tie into those trends if you don't sell in one of those categories? Is it, 'cause I've always heard that, like, you know, one of the great copywriters that I used to follow, he talked about getting people in kind of a buying frenzy. And like, he's like, you should always join in the whole sales from, you know, Thanksgiving through New Year's, because people just get in the buying habit almost. And this buying frenzy, he called it. Is there a way to take advantage? I know we're going on vacation this summer, and I know a lot of people they said it's going to be one of the busiest travel years probably ever because of that revenge kind of spending on travel. Is there a way, if you sell something completely unrelated to any of these, like a course online, is there a way to take advantage of that?
More than likely. And there's two ways. One would be with using scarcity-based marketing or time pressure. So scarcity is the limited quantities or limited availability or the perceived limited quantities or limited availability. And then time pressure there's high time pressure and low time pressure. High time pressure is very little time remaining in order to complete a specific call to action, whereas low time pressure is more than enough time with ample decision-making ability. And so we'll start with scarcity. So perceived availability, perceived limited quantities, or limited quantities, limited availability. There's a difference between saying, enjoy, let's use an industry that's not really affected by revenge spending. So we'll say cell phone sales. iPhone 25 is available at the Apple Store at a discounted rate of this dollar amount. Okay, great, no big deal. There's not really a button on it. But I was to say, well, there's 16 iPhones 25s remaining at this store. Get yours before supplies last. And it's just basic generic copy. But you're saying there's a limited quantity. And so it drives us to act faster. With time pressure, you're putting a time limit on it and say available until Tuesday, till 5 o'clock, last day only, ends at the end of the month. So you're putting a button on it and saying you can only get it until there's X number remaining, or if there is the time runs out. So this is common in e-commerce sales for, say, travel. And I know we're going back to the travel industry, but this has even been pre-pandemic. So you might see something that says, Sean, there are three tickets. No, we're searching for an airplane ticket. There are three tickets remaining at this price. Most consumers freak out and say, oh my God, only three tickets remaining. But what they didn't catch was at this price. There's probably 64 tickets remaining, but three at this price. And so if you miss out on those three, it might only increase by 3%, but you don't know that. And so by the uncertainty, the fear of missing out, the unknown, it drives us to make a decision. And then what we do is then we choose, okay, I'll get this now. And then we hit the timer. Sean, you have 2 minutes and 56 seconds remaining to complete this order. 55 seconds, 54 seconds. How do we respond? Yeah. We type real fast, misspell our name, pull out our credit card, panic, fear, and anxiety all over an airline ticket. But then when we measure how consumers feel in qualitative studies, the most common answer that consumers give is they feel like they won. What did you win? Right? The company marketed, they got your money, you got an airline ticket. So, but it was gamified by showing there was only a few left and then a time limit. So you have to race. You're now in a race against time. You're a race against other consumers to be the first one to get it, or at least in the next three. And so it's gamified. And not only does the consumer feel like they've won, it's a better customer experience and they're more likely to return, and they don't feel like they spent money.
That's amazing. Yeah. It's, and to me, like, there's almost a picture. I know exactly what you're talking about. There's almost, to me, I get a picture in my head of like all the people in the airport. Like, I literally see like that crowd all trying to buy tickets, you know, when I see something like that. And I even know what they're doing. Like, I know it's at this price, but I'm like, but is this the final at this price? Or is this, you know, the first or second version of this? Like, because you don't know. There are a limited number of seats. You know, you couldn't do that with some things, but with airline seats, you can obviously do it for that flight, you know, at that time. There's a lot of built-in scarcity there for sure that they can enjoy. Yeah, it's fascinating. There's so many different things here. Why don't you tell us a little bit about ClickSuasion, what you guys do, who it's for, and then we'll wrap up.
ClickSuasion Labs is a full service marketing agency with a niche in consumer psychology. There are two teams, there's a team of researchers who are psychologists and study behavioral science, behavioral economics, behavioral finance, social science, human judgment, decision making, who identify how people make decisions and then make recommendations and apply that to marketing campaigns. Then team number two is our marketing team, who writes copy, crafts digital campaigns, behavioral targeting, enhanced websites for you know, tracking, or you know, whatever the challenge might be. So an applied science team and then applied marketing team, and combined together, we're a full service marketing firm with a niche in consumer psychology. And the lab door is always open. If you're ever in Pinehurst, North Carolina, you're always more than welcome to visit.
And your website?
ClickSuasion.com, ClickSuasion.com.
Very cool.
Where's that cool little, you know, ticket?
Oh, yeah, I should put that back up, shouldn't I? I should put that back up. There you go. It's back up.
Making me work over here.
I know, right? See if you could spell. I saw your eyes going up trying to grab that spelling from third grade down. So is there any particular person or size company or anything like that that you guys prefer or work with? Or I know you got some great blog articles for at least that, everybody that's listening should go check out the blog and some cool articles and research there.
I appreciate that. I appreciate the mention for the blog. So on our website, there's a plethora of complimentary items. Let me just be transparent. We have a zero sales policy here. We'll never sell you anything. Even if you walk in the front door of the lab, we'll never sell you anything. If you want to work with us, all you have to do is say so, and then we'll make it happen. So we'll never sell you anything. So engage with the content, and no one's going to contact you and sell you anything. I forgot the question.
Is there any particular type of company that you prefer?
There you go. I'm so into this conversation. I just lose track of what I'm talking about.
That's all right. There's the Johnny Blue, one of the two. You haven't had many sips though. So
possibly. I know I still have a little bit left. I got to finish it here shortly. Specific companies. Here's our criteria. We like people to have fun, and we like people who enjoy evidence-based marketing. So if you like to have fun and you do evidence-based marketing, more than likely we would be willing to assist regardless of scope or size of the campaign or what you're looking for.
Very cool. All right. Well, you and I need to talk off air. I've got a couple of clients that we can definitely talk about. Well, that's going to be a wrap. Dr. Michael, it's been a pleasure having you on. This is fun. We could probably talk all kinds of little nuances and rabbit trails and deep dives and everything else. But everybody should go check out ClickSuasion, the blog, dive into some of the research there. It's really, really interesting and very cool stuff. And take your notebook with you, because you'll probably get some ideas for your own marketing as you're going through that stuff, and some things to at least test and try on your own site or in your own business. Again, Dr. Michael, thanks for coming. You can find us everywhere fine podcasts are sold. Apple's, iTunes. Jonathan usually does this, so I'm butchering it right now. So let's see, Apple, Spotify, all the other places podcasts are sold. Dr. Michael, thanks for being a guest.
Pleasure's all mine.